This Sandwell News podcast is divided into chapters.
Welcome to the Sandwell News for the blind and visually impaired community living in and around Sandwell. This is the edition due to be with you on Saturday the 28th of March, after which we take a much-deserved two-week break for Easter.
The clocks go forward an hour on Sunday, the 29th of March. This is reflected in the sunrise time for this week, which will be at 7:45. Sunset will be at 7:40 p.m. By midweek, temperatures should be around 14 degrees. It will still be quite windy in the earlier part of the week.
Some of the pieces from the week's readings from The Express and Star. Wednesday, March the 18th. I cannot live with this man, murder trial told. Tram revival is a step in the right direction. Thursday. Baggies £17 million loss. Extra money for pothole problems. Police crackdown on violent crime. In remembrance of Amelia Culper. Friday. More prisoners to be tagged. Opening of two rail stations a boon for the community. Pathologist gives evidence in murder trial. Saturday. Peter Rhodes has passed away. Peter Rhodes remembered. Tiverdale gets £20 million. Harry Mitchell Centre will be demolished to make way for new housing. Fast tracking the 74 bus service. Monday. Morris warns Albion players, don't get carried away. Man charged after hitting lamppost. Have your say in Smethwick New Homes development. Royal Mail fails letter test. Tuesday. Advice on reducing the risk of heart attack. Oldbury pub licence is being reviewed after stabbing. Smethwick's bid to become town of culture. Teenager dies after hospital fails to diagnose cause of stomach pain.
All those stories and more brought to us courtesy of Express and Star newspapers. As usual, about hour and a quarter in, we'll have the listings for the forthcoming week's television and radio, and possibly another item from Talking News Federation if we've got space. We'll also hear from Sophia again, this time about a project she's involved with, collecting some of the memories and oral history of blind people in and around Wolverhampton and South Staffordshire, which actually might include Sandwell. There is a piece coming up about that later in the rundown of activities coming up in April and May at SVI. And one of the first things is to talk about this project on April the 1st at the SVI office in West Bromwich. That's the Tea and Toast session. I must also warn you, carrying on from the warning we had last week about a mad dog, attack dog, and on the loose around the West Bromwich area. Apparently that animal is still at large. So SVI office sent me a message to tell you all to be careful if you have a guide dog, because that creature is still at large, I'm afraid. So in the meantime, we'll get on with this week's news. Rather shorter piece for Wednesday's news, read by Pam, because something appears to have happened to James, one of our regular readers. We do hope he's okay.
Hello, this is Pam with a couple of articles from The Express and Star, Wednesday the 18th of March. There wasn't that much news about Sandwell in today's paper, so it's just a couple of articles, as I say, this time. I cannot live with this man, murder accused's wife told police. A woman found dead at her home in a town near West Bromwich previously told police she could no longer live with the man accused of her murder, a court has heard. Paramjit Kaur, aged 46, known as Sonny, was found with serious injuries by police officers on March the 31st at her home in Swan Crescent, Oldbury. A statement made to West Midlands Police by Mrs. Kaur, dated December the 15th, 2024, was read aloud at Wolverhampton Crown Court yesterday by barrister Mr. Jonathan Barker, prosecuting. It related to an incident where she reported that husband Harminder Mathew, also known as Ninder, had beaten her up. The court heard how he used his hands to twist her leg, leaving her struggling to walk following a row, and that she had listed a series of other incidents when he was violent to her. She stated, "I can honestly say that I am terrified of Ninder. I am looking to divorce him. I gave him chance after chance, but after last night, I cannot live with this man anymore." Mr. Barker told the jury that sometime after making the statement, she contacted the case officer to retract it. Matu, aged 50, denies murder. The trial continues. Express and Star comment by Dr. Steve McCabe from Birmingham City University. Tram revival is a step in the right direction a century later. Expansion of the Midland Metro represents a return to the vision of the future. And this article is accompanied by several pictures. First one is a tram in Wolverhampton Centre, possibly dated 1913. And then there's a picture of the expanded West Midlands Metro. And there's a picture of horse-drawn trams in West Bromwich in 1903, shortly before they stopped. Trams were most definitely seen as the future for transportation. In many of the suburbs in Birmingham and the Black Country, there are what are known as central reservations. Central grass strips, often with trees along the edges, creating a dual carriageway, whilst giving the sense of greater greenery than would otherwise be the case. Those living nearby or passing by probably rarely consider why these strips were created. These boulevards were created when such suburbs were being built as the city expanded following the First World War, and to deal with the rapidly increasing population, which between 1901 and 1931 nearly doubled from 522,204 to 1,002,603. Major arterial roads out of the city were laid in order to accommodate trams that would extend outwards in what is now the grassed sandwich between the two roads. A century ago, when trams were in their heyday, this form of transit was seen as an efficient and effective way to move people. Today, the West Midlands Metro is continuing to grow, with several major projects aimed at improving connections across the region. Among the most significant is the 11-kilometre extension from Wensbury to Brierley Hill, which will run through Tipton and Dudley, bringing tram services to areas that have not had rail links for decades. In Birmingham, work is also progressing on the East Side extension, which will extend the network to Digbeth and Curzon Street, the future site of the Birmingham-Curzon Street railway station. Further ahead, there are plans to extend the network towards Solihull and Birmingham Airport, creating improved links between the city, surrounding towns and key transport hubs. When trams first appeared, they ensured all citizens could travel around the city on the major routes for commuting, shopping and schools, and were perceived as the height of luxury, certainly when compared to using horse-drawn carriages or bicycles when introduced. Trams were most definitely seen as the future for transportation, but many died out in the 1930s and 1940s, with the final two lost in Birmingham on July 4, 1953. The network for Birmingham was extensive and was linked to the Black Country. Trams, a form of transportation for fare-paying passengers, then normally consisted of a double-deck carriage on rails and derived from the Scandinavian word for a beam or bulk of wood, were first introduced on the Oystermouth Railway to allow trips between Swansea and the Mumbles in South Wales. It took until 1872 for trams to be introduced in our region, when Birmingham and District Tramways Company built a route between the city boundary at Hockley Brook via Handsworth to West Bromwich. The Midland Metro has brought trams back to the streets, with breakout sections in Wolverhampton and Birmingham, along with new sections being prepared for Dudley and Brierley Hill. The modern version is air-conditioned and far more comfortable than the constructed wooden carriages on metal bogies, which could be uncomfortably hot in summer and decidedly chilly in winter. Very sadly, the system is unlikely to ever replicate the extensive tram system which existed across the West Midlands a century ago. That said, there's no doubt that the reintroduction of light rail trams enabling citizens to travel with speed within Birmingham and the Black Country represents a phenomenal improvement on transport options that have been, it has to be said, somewhat lacking in the regularity and reliability essential to the continued prosperity of any modern city. Anyone who's travelled on the trams elsewhere in the UK, most particularly Manchester and Sheffield, as well as the vast majority of European cities, will attest to how important trams are to effective transport and economic development. As has been well known for many years and was or is being addressed by the leaders of the West Midlands Combined Authority, Birmingham and the West Midlands suffer from a range of transport issues, including congested and substandard roads, which, as well as making commuting and travel challenging, undermines the prosperity of the region. Experiences of travellers in Birmingham and the Black Country contrast starkly to those in London, who benefit from an integrated system of buses and the underground, which means that it's perfectly possible to get rapidly from one side of the capital to the other. We are all well aware of how much money was spent on London's Crossrail service, now the Elizabeth Line, which cost almost £19 billion and exceeded the original budget by £4 billion. If you've not yet travelled on this line, I'd highly recommend, as it's truly impressive. Whilst perfectly understandable for a city the size of London and with a population of 9 million to move people around and in which the country's power and wealth is concentrated, here in the West Midlands we can only dream of how similar investment would bring immense social and economic benefit to us. Nevertheless, the return of trams as part of the Midlands Metro represents a vital step in the right direction, and will underpin efforts being made to make Birmingham and the West Midlands the thriving hub of industry and commerce which characterised them when trams were in their heyday 100 years ago. It might be said the Midland Metro represents a return to the vision of the future which those leading Birmingham corporation shared in planning the development of the city as it rapidly expanded in the 1920s.
Hi, this is Debbie with some articles from the Express and Star from the 19th of March. Baggies reveal losses of £17 million by Lewis Cox. Albion have reduced their annual losses by almost half, according to the club's latest set of accounts. West Bromwich Albion Group Limited, the club's parent company owned by Shilin Patel's Bilcool Football Group, posted a loss of £17 million in the 12-month period to June 2025, covering the 2024-25 season. The loss is down from £31 million from the previous set of accounts, as Albion continued to recover after Bilcool's takeover from Goa Chuan Lai in February 2024. WBA Group's financial figures are those governed by the English Football League's Profit and Sustainability Financial Regulations. Football League clubs are not permitted to exceed losses of £39 million over a rolling three-year cycle, but certain spending, such as on the club's Category A academy, is calculated outside of this, meaning the club remains inside the £39 million threshold. The latest accounts, which will be published on Companies House website in the coming days, show how owner and chairman Patel invested £31 million in the 16 months between takeover and the completion of the accounting period. He invested £17.6 million for the 2024-25 campaign, up from £8.7 million in the final months of 2023-2024. As well as that, the Florida Businessmen's Ownership Group have covered the interest figure of £5.2 million incurred from the MSD loans taken out in the final months of the disastrous Lai regime. The outstanding balance of loans from American firm MSD, which were £20 million and £8 million taken in 2022 and 2023 respectively, stands at £25 million. It has a repayment deadline of December 2026, which the owner is committed to pay. Extra funding will help tackle pothole problems by Mimi Ibrahim. A council in the Black Country is investing £1.5 million to fix potholes. Sandwell Council Cabinet has said that they will fund an extra £1.5 million to fix and maintain roads and footpaths across the area. The council has said that this funding will come from a mixture of council funding and also Department for Transport. Sandwell Council have said that they hope that this funding boost will mean that they will invest more than £14 million in total over the next year on maintaining the borough's roads, footpaths and streetlights. The additional £1.5 million will specifically support maintaining local residential roads as well as footpaths in neighbourhoods and town centre shopping areas. Sandwell Council shared that they are celebrating a new green rating, which is part of the UK government's new national traffic light system that's in place for highway maintenance. Well-maintained roads and footpaths are vital for people's safety and to connect them to jobs, education and services, said Councillor Keith Alcock, Sandwell Council's Cabinet Member for Environment and Highways. We are proud of the national recognition we have received for the condition of our roads, our planned approach to prevent potholes from forming, and in cases where potholes do appear, for example following wintry weather, the speed, quality and reliability of our repairs. We are pleased to be able to invest a further £1.5 million over the coming year to give some extra focus to our local residential roads and footpaths in our neighbourhoods and town centres. This shows that we are a caring council that gets things done on the issues that matter most to our residents. Police make arrests and crack down on violent and organised crime. Police have made 26 arrests during the latest crackdown on violent and organised crime in Tipton. The launch of Operation Scarlet Fox aimed to increase information reported into the police, increase arrests and disrupt criminal networks. Police say they have seen success with the operation while addressing residents' concerns about the impact of violent, organised and gang-related crimes in the Tipton area. Since the start of February, West Midlands Police say they have made 26 arrests for offences including possession of drugs with intent to supply, possession of a bladed article, possession of a firearm and going equipped. People have also been charged in connection with driving offences, with 12 vehicles seized, more than 90 stop and searches carried out and a firearm recovered. Chief Inspector Michelle Allen said, "We are determined to make the streets of Tipton safer, and the launch of Op Scarlet Fox is our response to tackle serious crime in the area." She has put on her angel wings. Heartbreak as Amelia Culpa, 8, dies weeks after breaking birthday card record. By Daniel Walton. This article is accompanied by a colour photograph of a little girl in a pink coat with a grey woolly hat, and she has a nasal tube going up and she's smiling at the camera. Youngster Amelia Culpa, who captured hearts across the Black Country with her true courage, has died aged 8. Amelia, from Rowley Regis, had been battling stage 4 high risk neuroblastoma since she was 2 years old. To celebrate her 8th birthday this year while under palliative care, an appeal to grant her a simple birthday wish for cards saw her receive more than 300,000 birthday cards, smashing the 8,000 target and capturing the hearts of people across the region. The thoughts of the region are with the family of Amelia after her heartbroken mum, Katarzyna Barczak, announced her death on Tuesday night, saying she is no longer suffering. Her mother wrote in a social media post, "My dear ones, I'm writing this with a pain that words cannot describe. Today at 5 p.m, our beloved, bravest little warrior, Amelia, passed away. She has put on her angel wings. She is no longer suffering. She is no longer in pain. She's in a place where everything is beautiful, peaceful and full of light. For nearly 6 years, she fought with a strength beyond imagination. Every single day, she showed us what true courage looks like. She showed the whole world that even the smallest heart can hold the greatest power. And that love, pure, unconditional love, truly overcomes everything. Our dearest Amelia, you were and always will be our greatest miracle, our heart, our light. Thank you for every moment, every smile, every glance, for the love you taught us. This is not goodbye, it is see you again, our little angel. We love you forever.
This is Lauren with some stories from the Express and Star from the 20th of March. Thousands more to be fitted with tag after leaving prison. GPS and alcohol monitoring will keep an eye on the behaviour of offenders. Analysis. Thousands more criminals are set to be tagged as the government launches a major overhaul of the probation system in a bid to cut reoffending. Under plans to be announced by Probation Minister Lord James Timpson, almost all offenders will be tagged on leaving prison. Bailed as the biggest expansion of tagging in British history and backed by £100 million, the move will see greater use of GPS and alcohol monitoring, as well as proximity tags, to keep domestic abusers away from their victims. The tags should allow probation officers to monitor offenders' behaviour and potentially return them to jail if they fail to follow rules set out on their release. Lord Timpson said the expansion of tagging would mean the most dangerous offenders will now be watched more closely than ever before. The move is part of a major reform of the probation service, leaning heavily on technology to help overworked staff use their time better. As well as a presumption that offenders leaving prison will be tagged, the Ministry of Justice, MOJ, will invest £8 million in new technology aimed at cutting administrative tasks. That includes the MOJ's in-house AI tool, Justice Transcribe, to take notes during probation officers' meetings with the offenders they supervise, which has been welcomed by frontline staff. The government will also recruit at least 1,300 new probation officers over the next year, while low-risk offenders will receive less regular supervision, allowing staff to focus on those that pose the greatest danger. Currently, almost a third of probation appointments do not take place due to significant workloads representing thousands of missed appointments per year. Some 246,502 people were being supervised by the probation service in September last year, the most recent date for which statistics are available. Lord Timpson said, "By combining new technology with a stronger probation workforce, we're making sure those who pose the biggest risk are under constant scrutiny to better protect victims and the public." The reforms follow the passing of the Sentencing Act that will see offenders released earlier, with most leaving prison after serving a third of their sentence, rather than half or 40%. It is understood that the MOJ expects those offenders to be tagged for at least the second third of their sentence. Probation officers will then determine whether the offender should continue to be tagged for the final third. More serious offenders will serve at least half of their sentence behind bars. Martin Jones, the Chief Inspector of Probation, said he welcomed the proposals and the bid to focus time and resources where they matter most. He said, "We are entering a crucial period as the implementation of the Sentencing Act reform begins. There must be a sharp focus on ensuring the probation service can recruit, train and retain sufficient staff and give them the tools and support they need, both to keep the public and victims safe and to turn offenders' lives around." Victims Commissioner Claire Waxman also welcomed the proposals, but said tagging should be backed by swift, robust enforcement the moment a breach occurs, our risk creating a false sense of security for victims. She added, "Whilst prioritising high-risk offenders is a pragmatic necessity, it is essential that lower risk is never treated as no risk. Ultimately, victim safety must remain the priority." Pia Sinner, Chief Executive of the Prison Reform Trust, warned the presumption that all offenders would be tagged on leaving prison could undermine efforts to reduce pressure on prisons. She said, "Electronic monitoring is not a panacea for reducing reoffending. Whilst it can be a useful option as part of licence conditions, evidence shows it is most effective when combined with appropriate supervision and support." She added, Tagging can be an effective tool for enhancing monitoring and supervision, but it also carries the risk of increased stigmatisation, which can undermine resettlement and reintegration on release. Comment section. The wider use of electronic tags on offenders leaving prison is a welcome move if it ensures they behave themselves and that victims are protected. But concerns will be raised that the expansion of electronic monitoring will simply be an excuse for prisoners to be allowed out early, before justice has been seen to be done. Under plans to be announced by Probation Minister Lord James Dixon, almost all offenders will be tagged on leaving prison. Billed as the biggest expansion of tagging in British history and backed by £100 million, the move will see greater use of GPS and alcohol monitoring, as well as proximity tags to keep domestic abusers away from their victims. The tags should allow probation officers to monitor offenders' behaviour and potentially return them to jail if they fail to follow set rules out on their release. Lord Timpson said the expansion of tagging would mean the most dangerous offenders will now be watched more closely than ever. He is an advocate of rehabilitation of prisoners through his work at his chain of shops, where many former offenders are given the chance to start a new life and forge a career. It is clear that the process of going to prison should be about both punishment, but also learning how not to reoffend upon release. The use of electronic tags can aid that process by flagging up bad behaviour. With a proper probation system, it can both help offenders who want to improve their lives and punish those who go back to old ways. But with jails full to bursting and courts suffering huge backlogs, the fear is tags will simply be used to clear up space in prison cells. It is a classic example of technology having a completely counterproductive impact on those that use them. Experts believe sleep apps can actually make the situation worse for many people. Anxiety plays a key part in insomnia. Those who cannot sleep overthink. The more they worry about not sleeping, the less they sleep. Sleep apps embedded in wearable devices such as smartwatches and fitness bands have become increasingly common. They help many people assess their patterns and adapt their lifestyles accordingly. But a new study suggests those who suffer insomnia may want to ditch the app and take more simple steps, such as keeping a regular sleep pattern and avoiding screen time at night. The golden rule is that technology can help, but it is not the cure of all ills. Alongside this article, analysis and comment is a picture of the new tags to be fitted. It is a zoomed-in picture of someone's ankle wearing a white sock and a brown trainer. The tag looks like a watch. It's black with a black band and a circular section. It's hard to read what's on it, but there are some digital numbers and presumably saying how long they have been out, etc. There is a person's hands fitting it on them. And it's captioned, an electronic tagging device used on offenders. Mayor, opening of railway stations is huge moment for communities. The opening of two new railway stations in the Black Country End, a long wait for residents eager to reconnect to the railway network. Richard Parker, Mayor of the West Midlands, said the reopening of Willenhall and Darlaston stations is a huge moment for communities that have been cut off from the rail network for six decades. "I promised to restore these vital links, and today we've delivered. These stations will bridge the gap to new jobs and leisure, revitalising our high streets and driving local growth. We're already working behind the scenes to expand the timetable and create even more opportunities for everyone in the area." The new stations have been built near the sites of their historic predecessors, combining modern facilities with a revival of the area's rail heritage. Darlaston Station includes a large park and ride car park with around 300 spaces, whilst Willenhall offers additional parking for commuters. Both locations are expected to become key transport hubs, linking the Black Country more effectively with Birmingham, Wolverhampton and beyond. "It's a godsend," Willenhall resident Paul Jay said. "I live just over the road in the flats, and it's going to make a big difference for me having the station here. It's like having my own personal railway station, and I know a lot of people over there are really happy. I'll be using it at least three times a week." The first departures were underway just before 7 a.m. yesterday. Passengers travelling towards Wolverhampton were able to board the 6:47 a.m. service from Darlaston, followed by a 6:50 a.m. departure from Willenhall. For those heading into Birmingham New Street, services left Willenhall at 7:07 a.m. and Darlaston at 7:11 a.m. The reopening of stations in both towns is expected to improve access to jobs, education and leisure, whilst easing pressure on local roads. Local leaders have described the openings as a significant step forward for the Black Country, restoring railway connections that many communities have been without for decades. Alongside this article is a picture of Willenhall Railway Station. It's a bird's eye view of what just looks like an industrial site. Lots of housing, lots of buildings, a road on one side with the railway passing through the centre. It does look new, very modern, with some old bits and some old architecture weaved in throughout. It's captioned, Willenhall Railway Station opened for the first time yesterday. Evidence of neck pressure, pathologist tells murder trial. Doctor tells jury there was also clear evidence of victim suffering a sharp force injury. Written by Paul Jenkins. A home office pathologist giving evidence on the third day of a trial of an Albury man accused of killing his wife said there was clear evidence of her having pressure applied to her neck. Paragymic Kaur, aged 46, was found dead on Monday, March 31st, around 8 a.m, at the home in Swan Crescent, Albury, she shared with her husband, Harminder Mathieu, who is on trial for her murder. Dr. Alexander Collar, a pathologist who examined Mrs. Kaur's body, took the stand at Wolverhampton Crown Court and said there was clear evidence of neck pressure and that it was an important factor in her death. But he also said there was clear evidence of her suffering a sharp force injury, described as being a stab-type wound, which had gone 2.4 centimetres into her body. Under questioning by prosecuting barrister Mr. Jonathan Barker, who suggested Mrs. Kaur may have suffered asphyxiation, the doctor said he would stop short of describing it as that, but said there was evidence of pressure being applied. He said there was internal bleeding and on the skin surface, damage to the jawbone and both the upper and lower jaw, with the evidence of pressure being applied there as well. I would say there were clear signs of trauma, though I would stop short of categorising it as asphyxia. Her face was red in colour and the inside of the lips were damaged. All these I saw as red flags towards applied neck pressure. Mr. Barker asked what went to the hospital to carry out the examination, and he said he had been given information that Mrs. Kaur had been stabbed. Dr. Kohler said, but there were also scratch marks to her neck with clear signs of a struggle. Mathieu, aged 50, of Swan Crescent, Albury, denies murder. The trial continues.
Hello, this is Sarbjit with your news from The Express and Star, dated Saturday, 21st of March. A true friend to all our readers. There is a picture of Peter Rhodes, who had been writing for The Express and Star for 40 years, by Mark Andrews. Much-loved Express and Star columnist Peter Rhodes has died after a short illness. He was one of the newspaper's best-loved writers for more than 40 years, and his column was part of the daily routine for thousands. Peter revealed in December he was suffering from cancer. He had been writing his daily column up until he fell ill last autumn, and his illness sparked a wave of goodwill messages from readers. Peter's time with the Express and Star took him to the Arctic Circle, the Falkland Islands, the last days of British Hong Kong and South Africa as apartheid started to crumble. He took veterans back to the beaches of Normandy and spent a week touring the Black Country in a narrowboat. He celebrated 4 decades with the paper in August last year, just as it was revealed from a prostate test that he was suffering from cancer in the kidney. Peter retired from his day job as the newspaper's chief feature writer in 2012, but continued to write his weekday column. He began his career as a trainee on the Leamington Spa Courier in 1969, then joined the Express and Star in response to an advert for a top writer. He describes it as the best of moves and formed a strong bond with readers. He said, "I was proud to get the job all those years ago, proud to represent the paper known as the Bible of the Black Country, and especially proud on assignments all over this wild and wicked world to introduce myself, Peter Rhodes of the Express and Star, Mark Drew, an editor at the Express and Star, who had worked with Peter for more than 20 years, said, I said on Peter's retirement that he was the best wordsmith I have ever worked with. He had a remarkable knack of connecting with people and was also a very generous mentor to many of his colleagues. His columns were always a treat to read through. They always struck the right chord, were incredibly witty, but also often profound and powerful. He will be much missed, and our thoughts are with his family. Tom Graham, chairman of the Claverley Group, former owner of the Express and Star, added, Peter was a giant of the regional media world, and his wit and wisdom cemented his position as a household name in the Black Country. His close relationship with his readers was extraordinary. Indeed, he became so embedded in their lives that many regarded him as a close friend and guiding presence. More recently, he dealt with his terminal diagnosis with extraordinary positivity and pragmatism, so typical of Peter. We will all miss him hugely. Peter was great fun. He taught me so much. A personal tribute to Peter Rhodes from an old colleague and friend, by Mark Andrews. There is a picture of Peter Rhodes, who has died aged 74. He was admired by thousands of readers, but also was a huge influence to those he worked with. Deadline is looming. The newsroom is reverberating to the sound of ringing phones, tense hacks hammering away at their keyboards. Any conversations are terse and to the point. And then, sat in the corner of the room, reclining in his chair, Peter Rhodes would be engrossed in a 15-minute debate with a reader about whether young people in the 1960s had better manners than they do today. He didn't think they did. People say they don't suffer fools gladly, he once remarked. I think my problem is that I do. Peter loved to chat, and I quickly learned that he would chat to anybody about anything and everything. In the cutthroat world of modern journalism, where time is tight and speed is everything, Peter was a firm believer that everybody had a tale to tell and would listen to anybody. His career had seen him mingle with a glittering array of stars, and in his later years, he would constantly email asking me to dig out his old interviews from the archives. But he never seemed happier than when he was engrossed in a lengthy telephone conversation with a reader about the finer points of something he had written in his column. He truly was the reader's friend. For somebody who was actually a rather mild-mannered and reserved person, he was, nevertheless, a big presence in the newsroom. I never once heard him raise his voice, in itself quite unusual in a high-pressurized environment, but woe betide anyone who changed his work without consulting him. Every morning he would wander through the sea of sober grey suits, dominating the newsroom in his tweed sports jacket and olive green cords, humming to himself before peering authoritatively over the rim of his half-round spectacles to inspect how his work had been presented. In my early days as a youngish sub-editor on the features desk, I once made the mistake of confusing so, S-E-W, with so, S-O-W, on the headline of something he had written. I never made that mistake again. But he was also very supportive, and he, more than anyone else, encouraged me to make the transition from jobbing news reporter to feature writer. He taught me that facts, figures and information were all very well, but people were what really mattered, and one heartfelt quote was more powerful than a dozen dry statistics. He drummed into me the importance of helping the reader imagine they were in the situation they were reading about, and that every word, every minor detail could make that happen. Reporters conveyed information, but feature writers painted a picture. To say that he taught me all that I know would perhaps be churlish to many others, but he was a great mentor and an influence on my career. But please don't hold that against him. It was a privilege to take over his role when he retired from the day job in 2012, and he was the first to congratulate me. But I always knew there would be only one Peter Rhodes. Peter, who would actually hate being referred to by his first name in print, they only use first names when it is a child or an old person, had an incredible talent for turning the most unremarkable domestic situation into a ripping yarn, and for finding humour in the most unlikely of situations. The ethical dilemmas of hiring a gardener or selling a tired old car to a gullible punter were subjects of his columns from well over 30 years ago, but still raise a smile. And a whole generation of readers followed the story of his daughter, Cherie, from infancy to adolescence. In what can sometimes be an all-consuming industry, Peter was a firm believer that we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously and that family always came first. The graveyards are full of indispensable people, he would often say, and few people on their deathbeds wish they had spent more time in the office. He loved his holidays in Beer, East Devon, and he kept a photograph of his beloved boat on his desk. When he retired, we surreptitiously photocopied the picture and asked a local artist to turn it into a watercolour. The artist was so honoured that he painted the picture within a couple of days, free of charge. Working with Peter Rhodes was huge fun and a great education. He will be missed by those who worked with him, but also by his thousands of loyal readers. Tivadale receives £2 million a year for the next 10 years as part of Pride in Place initiative by Mark Andrews. An area of the Black Country is to receive a £20 million boost after securing the funds through a government regeneration scheme. Tivadale will receive £2 million a year for the next 10 years after being one of 40 neighbourhoods selected through the government's £5 billion Pride in Place initiative. A local board of volunteers will be set up to decide how the money is spent. West Bromwich MP Sarah Coombs, who campaigned for the investment alongside Sandwell Council leader Councillor Kerry Carmichael and Tivadale Councillor Maria Crompton, celebrated the announcement. Miss Coombs said it was a once-in-a-generation opportunity for the area. She has launched an online survey for people to express their views on how the money should be spent. Early suggestions included a community centre and youth club, she said. There is a problem with antisocial behaviour in Tivadale. Young people are standing around in the streets drinking and taking drugs, so if we could have more youth clubs and activities to give them something to do, that would be a help. There is also a lot of fly tipping, and the green spaces could do with a bit of sprucing up. But £20 million is a lot of money, so there is also the potential for some very big projects. A call has already gone out to people to volunteer to sit on a local board that helps coordinate the project. Miss Coombs said, "When I was elected, I promised to stand up for the people of Tivadale and fight for the funding that we deserve. Working with Sandwell Labour Council, we have delivered this £20 million investment for the community. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity, and Tivadale residents will decide how every penny of this money is spent." Councillor Kerry Carmichael, leader of Sandwell Council, said the investment would be a major boost for the area. Demolition of Centre Approved to Make Way for New Housing by Christian Barnett, local democracy reporter. There is a picture of the Harry Mitchell Leisure Centre on Londonderry Lane, Smethwick. Plans to demolish a deteriorating leisure centre to make way for new homes has been backed by councillors. Sandwell Council's Cabinet has approved plans to demolish the 125-year-old Harry Mitchell Leisure Centre in Smethwick as part of plans to flatten the site for housing. The local authority said the leisure centre was surplus to requirements and demolition of the building is currently expected to cost around £711,000. The council said early plans include between 30 and 45 new houses and flats, but could reach as many as 80 dwellings. The Labour-run council's cabinet approved the work at a meeting on March 11. Councillor Saida Khatun, the council's cabinet member for business and skills, said the borough had a surplus of leisure facilities and the jewel in the crown, Sandwell Aquatic Centre, was less than a mile away. Councillor Khatun said it had always been the council's intention to close Harry Mitchell as part of the opening of the £73 million leisure centre to the public following the 2022 Birmingham Commonwealth Games. Sandwell Council said Harry Mitchell Leisure Centre was the oldest and poorest facility in the borough and would need at least £1.5 million, according to a 2018 survey, to completely refurbish the building and bring it to standard. The leisure closed casually in May last year and was empty by October. Parts of the leisure centre relocated to Sandwell Aquatic Centre in 2024. The town's Thimbermill Baths and Langley Baths closed as part of the opening of the Sandwell Aquatic Centre and Sandwell Council revealed at the start of 2025 it was looking to give up Hadley Stadium in Smethwick and close the town's Harry Mitchell Leisure Centre as part of plans to save more than £500,000 through a review of its leisure facilities. This cabinet report said the £540,000 savings set out in the council's budget last year had been met through alternative sources, but resolving the future of the site would support the council's wider strategic review. Taking the site and its associated liabilities out of the leisure management portfolio will make Sandwell's leisure estate more sustainable, it said. The report said, since the 2018 survey, further deterioration has occurred, including significant roof leaks and water ingress, resulting in urgent repair needs. Given the escalating costs of repair, the limited scale of the facility, and the availability of high-quality alternative provision in the surrounding area, retention is no longer considered financially viable. Proposed new bus scheme to serve Key Route. A proposed new bus scheme to serve one of the busiest key routes in Birmingham is set to be backed. Members of the West Midlands Combined Authorities Investment Board are to discuss the £15.5 million cross-city bus package 6 West scheme. This programme is aimed at creating bus priority measures between Birmingham City Centre and West Bromwich, supporting the number 74 service. The aim of cross-city bus schemes are to journey times and reliability by enabling services to bypass congestion on busy routes. There are a total of 6 proposed for the city. Members of the investment board will be asked to approve the business case and total budget of £15.597 million for this scheme. If the whole project is approved, construction work is expected to start in August and be completed by June next year. A report to the board said, Cross City Bus is a programme for delivery of bus priority measures within the West Midlands region, being delivered as part of the Bus Priority Programme. Package 6 West provides bus priority measures between Birmingham City Centre and West Bromwich to support Bus Service 74, which operates along this corridor.
Albion Match Report. George Campbell scored the only goal as West Bromwich Albion edged past Bristol City and clinched a second consecutive victory in their bid to secure their championship status. Campbell headed home from a corner in the first half with what proved to be the only goal of the afternoon at Ashton Gate, as Albion climbed 4 points clear of the relegation zone, having secured their first away win in the league since October. With Oxford United and Portsmouth both being beaten elsewhere and Leicester City and Blackburn Rovers failing to win, this could prove to be a significant afternoon in the Baggies' season as they seek to avoid the drop into League One. For depleted Bristol City, who are having to cope without a host of defensive personnel, it is now just one win in 8 games after this latest underwhelming result, and home supporters voice their dissatisfaction before the end. West Brom threatened to break the deadlock in the opening 5 minutes. Josh Madger was the recipient when Ross McCrory surrendered possession in his own half. But having given Jason Knight the slip, the forward did not manage to get a clean strike away under pressure from Adam Randall. The Baggies did, though, open the scoring inside half an hour when Campbell rose highest to meet Callum Stiles' corner and powered home his fourth goal of the championship season, despite the efforts of Robbins, Captain Knight on the line. Bristol City struggled to pose many questions of Albion's back line in the first half, and in fact the visitors might have doubled their advantage before the break when Jason Mullumbilly fired a low drive just wide of Radekitek's post when a long throw-in was only half cleared. Robin's boss, Gerhard Struber, clearly bemused by his side's first half showing, made a triple substitution at half-time in the hope of gathering some momentum and introduced Sinclair Armstrong, Max Bird and Cameron Pring. They carved out the first notable opportunity of the second period too, when Bird and Emil Rees combined to create a chance for McCrory, who lost the attention of Stiles, but whose stinging drive was beaten away by Josh Griffiths in the visiting goal. West Brom responded to the home side's initial improvement by fashioning more openings of their own. Crystal Palace loanee Danny Imrie forced a decent save when shooting from distance from Vitek, who then afforded Albion another chance with a poor pass out from the back, and he had to deny Isaac Price's goal-bound effort. Still, while the scoreline remained precarious, Bristol City remained very much in the game. When Armstrong's low cross evaded fellow substitute Delano Bergzorg, Griffiths was called into action to prevent Stiles, his own teammate, from turning the ball into his own net. Albion saw the closing stages out in relative comfort, meaning they have now won 2 successive league matches for the first time since the opening weekends of the season. The playoffs for Bristol City, at one stage very much a realistic target, would now appear to be out of reach. James Morrison said, "I thought it was a top away performance and it had a bit of everything. There was the fight and determination I keep talking about, but when we were under pressure, we dealt with it. When we attacked, we got the opportunities. I'd have liked us to have put the game to bed, but we've seen it out. Everyone today was an 8 out of 10, and that's what you need when you're away from home. Hopefully this away form continues. In the back of my mind, it's only one part done now. They can have a nice couple of days off, but when they come back in, They've got to be ready to work and be ready to fight until the end. I keep reminding them about that. From now until the end of the season, there'll be ups and downs, as theirs always is in a relegation battle. It's about how we deal with that. It's a challenge, and we're looking forward to it.
Hello, this is Jenny. I hope this finds you well. Can't believe we're nearly at Easter already. The following articles are from the Express and Star newspaper, Monday the 23rd of March. Mozza's warning. Resurgent Albion are told not to get carried away. An article by Lewis Cox. James Morrison will send a warning to his Albion squad not to get carried away in the push for championship survival after rare back-to-back wins. Saturday's crucial 1-0 success at Bristol City made it successive league victories for the first time since the two weekends of the championship season in August. The Ashton Gate triumph in front of 3,200 away fans also ended an excruciating run of almost 6 months and 15 attempts without a league win away from the Hawthorns, as Morrison's resurgent side have moved 4 points clear of the drop. With 7 games remaining after the return from international action, however, Morrison knows the survival mission is far from complete, and vowed that he and Albion will work even harder to ensure focus. "Yes, exactly that," Morrison said. "There's still a long way to go. You've seen in football that when you get a bit too carried away, it can drop back down quickly. So that's up to me. My job to remind the players of that. We'll probably have to work a little bit harder, to be honest. I don't want anybody to get carried away. And that's up to me, to be honest. And I'll look at that day to day to see if the standards they set drops, and then I will come down on it." Morrison had hinted his players would be rewarded with more time off at the beginning of the international break if they could banish the club's away hoodoo with success at mid-table Bristol City. George Campbell's first half header proved the difference on a day the Baggies could have won by a greater margin in front of a bumper away end. The head coach remained coy on his squad's breather, and with some players jetting off for national duties, the Baggies are likely to resume for training a few days into this week. "The players deserve what they get," Morrison replied. "How I see it is that they deserve it, because they are doing what I'm asking. They are leaving everything on the pitch so they can rest up ready to go again. They'll get a few days off." Man charged as car hits lamppost. A man has been charged after two others were injured following a serious collision in the Black Country. A car hit a lamppost and parked cars in Newbury Lane, Oldbury, at just before 11 p.m. on Friday, police said. Two passengers were injured and taken to hospital. One man sustained serious injuries and the second suffered injuries not believed to be life-threatening. Following further inquiries, West Midlands Police said they had now established the vehicle was stolen. Corey Brown, 20, from Lye, has been charged with 2 counts of causing serious injury by dangerous driving, theft of a motor vehicle, driving while disqualified and having no insurance. He was remanded to appear before Wolverhampton Magistrates Court today. Police are appealing for witnesses via live chat or 101. Quote log 5866 of the 20th of the 3rd, 26. In brief, residents are being urged to have their say over a council's plans to build 100 new homes on the former factory land near the Metropolitan University Hospital in Smethwick. Sandwell Council wants to build 74 new flats and 26 houses at the old GKN factory site in Cranford Street and has used compulsory purchase powers to buy it. Anyone who wishes to make representations about these applications can do so via the website or via email to planning@samwell.gov.uk within 23 days of the date of this advertisement, quoting the application reference number DC
26/71442.
Royal Mail fails our letter test. 20 sent, only 12 on time, 6 were late and 2 are still missing. An article by Mark Andrews. Royal Mail is still failing to deliver a decent postal service for the West Midlands. That is the conclusion of a snapshot test carried out by the Express and Star, as customers across the region continue to complain about late deliveries. We sent 20 letters from a Black Country address to both our region and further afield. The Royal Mail says it expects 93% of first-class posts to arrive the next day. But in our test, only 12 out of 20 hit that target, just 60%. 6 letters were late and 2 continued to be missing in transit 19 days after they were sent. Today, the Royal Mail insists it is providing a good service and appeared to blame mistakes made by those posting the letters for the consistent delays. A spokesman who declined to be named said, "We know how important it is that customers receive their mail on time, particularly when it comes to important items. Recent figures show around 92% of letters arrive on time, but we recognise that performance is not yet where it needs to be in all areas. Items taking significantly longer than expected to arrive are not due to delays in the network and are more likely to be related to an issue with the item itself. The letters sent by the Express and Star all had a valid first-class stamp on and were fully addressed, including postcodes. One of the addresses still awaiting their letter is just around a mile away from the postbox where it was posted. It comes as a cross-party committee of MPs said the most recent figures show just 74% of first-class post was being delivered on time in the UK. Many of our local MPs have spoken in debates in Parliament, demanding improvements after being inundated with complaints about late deliveries. Today's figures come as retired heating engineer Martin Stanley revealed he recently received a Christmas card which was sent months ago at his home in Sedgley. The card took 3 months and one day to arrive from a friend who lives in Nottingham.
Hi, this is Kate and I'm reading you some articles from the Express and Star, dated the 24th of March. Avoid risk of heart attack by sleeping 11 minutes longer. Minor alterations in how we live can have dramatic impact on our future health. Simple steps can add up to a powerful protection against the risk of heart attack, according to a new report released today. And experts are very precise in the changes that we should all make if we want to keep our hearts healthy. Sleeping for 11 minutes more each night, doing 4.5 additional minutes of brisk walking, eating an extra quarter cup of vegetables each day can significantly reduce a person's risk of heart attack, according to the new study released today. Academics found that these small changes could help people to avoid major cardiovascular events, including heart attack and strokes, by around 10%. The ambitions for change are deliberately set to be modest. Small behavioural changes are more achievable and sustainable, the research team said. The study published in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology saw experts from Australia, Chile and Brazil examine data on more than 53,000 middle-aged UK adults taking part in the Biobank study. Researchers looked at people's sleep habits and levels of exercise through data from wearable technology like smartwatches. People also self-reported on their dietary habits. The researchers found that 2,034 major cardiovascular events occurred during an 8-year follow-up period. They were able to identify the optimal way people can avoid these incidents. They include a good diet, 8 to 9 hours sleep per night, and a minimum of 42 minutes or more moderate to vigorous physical activity each day. Combining these measures leads to a 57% lower risk of heart attack and stroke. They also found the clinically relevant combination of behaviours people can do to reduce their risk, including more sleep, better diet and more moderate to vigorous activity. According to the NHS website, moderate activity can include brisk walking, dancing, pushing a lawnmower, water aerobics and riding a bike. Vigorous activity includes running, swimming, skipping and aerobics. Dr. Nicholas Comel, lead author and research fellow at the University of Sydney, said, "We show that combining small changes in a few areas of our lives can have a surprisingly large positive impact on our cardiovascular health. This is very encouraging news because making a few small combined changes is likely more achievable and sustainable for most people when compared with attempting major changes in a single behaviour. Making even modest shifts in our daily routines is likely to have cardiovascular benefits as well as create opportunities for further challenges in the long run. I would encourage people not to overlook the importance of making a small change or two to your daily routine, no matter how small that they may seem." Professor Emmanuel Stamatakis, senior author of the study and professor of physical activity and population health at the University of Sydney and Monsey University, said, "We plan to build on these findings to develop new digital tools that support people in making positive lifestyle changes and establish sustained healthy habits. This will involve working closely with community members to make sure the tools are easy to use and can address the barriers we all face in making tweaks to our day-to-day routines." Medics say the lifestyle changes outlined in the new study should be coupled by other important steps to ensure the heart is working properly and to help avoid the risk of a heart attack or stroke. These include keeping a track of blood pressure, using a home monitor to keep regular check, and seeking medical advice from a GP if it appears to be regularly high or low. People should also ensure that they're getting regular checks on their cholesterol, the fatty substance that can obstruct blood vessels. The NHS states that people aged over 65, smokers, those with elevated blood pressure and people whose relatives have a history of heart disease are most at risk of a heart attack or stroke, but that lifestyle changes and regular monitoring can vastly reduce that risk. A hearing has been set to determine the fate of an Albury pub after a double stabbing. Samwell Council's Licensing Committee will meet on March the 27th to review the licence for the Bull's Head in Birchfield Lane, Albury, after two men were stabbed at the Bar and Grill in the early hours of March the 1st. The pub's licence was suspended on March the 5th and will remain so until the conclusion of next week's hearing. West Midlands Police have called for the licence review, saying it had significant concerns about the pub following the incident. The council's licensing committee has the power to suspend or revoke the pub's licence. Five people were arrested after two men were stabbed at the pub in the early hours of March the 1st. The two injured men in their 20s and 30s were taken to hospital with injuries not believed to be life-threatening. A 22-year-old man was arrested on suspicion of violent disorder and possession of Class B drugs, and a 38-year-old man was arrested on suspicion of violent disorder and possession of Class A drugs. Police also arrested two women, aged 34 and 44, and the 34-year-old man on suspicion of violent disorder. Purparim Emini became the licence holder in July 2020, and the designated premises supervisor has been Anastasia Sulugina since April 2021. The pub currently has permission to open until 12:30 a.m. during the week and 2:30 a.m. on Fridays and Saturdays. Several messages of support were submitted to the council after the request by West Midlands Police to review the licence, with regulars saying they did not want the pub to close over the stabbing. One supporter said, "I've every faith that they can restore the pub and their own reputation, just as they did when taking over this premises at the beginning around 5 years ago. The recent reports and ongoings have been caused by members of the public who are not regulars of this pub, and it would be disappointing that after one situation completely out of anyone's control, this would change the management of this establishment. The review application by West Midlands Police to Samwell Council said, on the 1st of March 2026, West Midlands Police were contacted by West Midlands Ambulance Service about a report of a person stabbed in the chest at the named premises. A report was received on a second person stabbing victim nearby. Rich history, proud people. That's the case being made today for Smethwick to become the UK's first town of culture. Samwell Council announced it would be entering Smethwick in the competition. It will be up against a long list of towns that have already put their name in the ring, including the likes of Bridgnorth, Loughborough, Boston and Droitwich. While many entries from are being pitched by picturesque market towns or centres of tourism, Smethwick will be firmly on its huge influence on the industrial development of Britain and its strong community. It also won £20 million in funding for improvements through the government's Plan for Neighbourhoods programme, a significant investment in the town that is now being consulted on. UK Town of Culture is a new competition run by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, targeting any town with a population of up to 75,000. The winning town will be awarded £3 million to deliver a cultural programme in 2028 of around 6 months. Additionally, the two finalists from their category will receive £250,000 each to deliver elements of their bid. Councillor Kerry Carmichael, leader of Samwell Council, said, "Today's Smethwick had a proud industrial past and was now a vibrant and cohesive community. The civil rights activist Malcolm X's visit to Marshall Street in 1965 was a historic moment after being invited by the Indian Workers Association. The visit was photographed by the Express and Star and now forms a mural in the town centre." Councillor Carmichael said, "Smethwick was now the proud home of Europe's biggest South Asian melia and Europe's largest gurdwara, while its high streets are lined with food from around the world, from local black country delicacies to independent cafes and famous Asian pubs and sweet centres. Smethwick is a uniquely diverse town within Samwell that prides itself on its hyper-local creative vibrancy and its community-driven spirit," she said. And this article is supported by a photograph of the mural mentioned in the article with Malcolm X, painted on the wall on Marshall Street. And there is a group of people standing in front of that. Teen died after hospital failed to detect cause of her severe abdominal pain. An inspiring nurse described as a beautiful soul died after repeated visits to Samwell General Hospital failed to detect the cause of her suffering severe abdominal pain. The family of 18-year-old Zana Afrifa, who lived in Smethwick, have reached a settlement with the Samwell and West Birmingham Hospitals NHS Trust after a medical negligence claim investigated by law firm Lyme Solicitors. She was found dead by her mother on September the 18th, 2021, after being discharged from the former Samwell General Hospital the previous morning. The Trust said that it was committed to learning lessons raised by the case. She had attended a hospital and her GP six times between October 2019 and her death, with her symptoms often attributed to constipation. However, Ms. Afrifa's underlying condition went undetected until a post-mortem examination revealed that she had suffered a very rare cecal volvus, or a twisting of the intestine usually seen in older patients. which led to peritonitis, an infection that can prove life-threatening if left untreated. Miss Afrifra, who was studying health and social care at college, worked part-time at a retirement village and had dreamed of going to university to become a nurse despite struggling with recurrent abdominal pain, vomiting and constipation for almost 2 years. Her distraught family explained that on the evening of September the 16th, 21, she was taken to A&E with the same symptoms. Her mother described how her daughter was in extreme distress while waiting to be seen. She was examined in the early hours of September the 17th and was told that she was constipated. She was treated and later discharged. Despite this, she remained unwell and sadly her mother found her unresponsive in bed the next morning. An inquest in October 2023 heard evidence about the rarity of the condition and recorded a conclusion of natural causes. However, the family felt the opportunity to recognise the seriousness of condition were missed. Lyme solicitors subsequently carried out a detailed investigation into her care, obtaining independent expert medical evidence. The family believed that critical blood test results were not reviewed during her final visit to the A&E, potentially allowing a serious infection to go undetected. They described her as a beautiful soul who brought warmth and kindness to everyone she met and hope that telling her story will help ensure that severe abdominal symptoms are always thoroughly investigated and appropriately escalated. Natalizia Capizzi, Medical Negligence Legal Director at Lyme Solicitors, said, "This case highlights how serious abdominal conditions can sometimes be overlooked when symptoms resemble more common illnesses." Samuel and West Birmingham Hospital's NHS Trust Chief Medical Officer Dr. Mark Anderson said, "We extend our deepest sympathies to all those who knew Zana for the heartbreaking loss. We have reflected on the circumstances of her tragic death and remain committed to learning any lessons that may help us improve patient safety."
When you asked to receive recordings produced by the Sandwell Talking News, you gave your name and address so that we could send you our memory sticks or CDs. This information is stored in a secure database and address labels are also stored in a secure location. Having left our premises, the address labels and postal wallets are then under the protection and care of Royal Mail. Your contact details are only used for sending you our memory sticks or CDs and will never be forwarded to a third party. If you ask us to stop sending the Sandwell Talking News to you, your contact details will be deleted from our database and your address labels will be permanently destroyed. We promise and assure you that we take data protection seriously and make every effort to meet the requirements of the Data Protection Act. If your circumstances do change, you move home, change your phone number, or wish to unsubscribe to the Sandwell Talking News, please call the office on 0121 525 4810 or email sandwelltn@gmail.com so that we can make the necessary changes.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Val from Wharfdale Talking News with my selection of audio described TV programmes for the period Saturday the 28th of March to Friday the 3rd of April, starting with Saturday the 28th. Raymond Blanc's Royal Kitchen Gardens is on ITV1 at 12 noon when he visits the Castle of May in Caithness. There are 4 episodes of Midsummer Murders on ITV3 this afternoon at 10 past 2, 5 past 4, 6pm and 8pm. The afternoon film on BBC Two at 2:30pm is the spy thriller The Ipcress File, starring Michael Caine. Or you might prefer the fantasy comedy The Mask over on BBC One at 3:45pm. Gladiators The Final is on BBC One at 5:45pm. Find out who has what it takes to claim the title of champion. Celebrity Catchphrase is on ITV1 at 5:50pm, when the celebrities say what they see as they try to solve a selection of well-known phrases. The documentary Chernobyl, 48 Hours to Escape, on Channel 4 at 7:50pm, promises new first-hand accounts from local residents and emergency workers who confronted the worst nuclear accident in history 40 years ago. The new four-part documentary series, Inside Britain's National Parks, starts tonight on BBC Two at 8:30pm, beginning with a visit to the New Forest. A new six-part series of the crime drama Hidden Assets starts with a double bill tonight on BBC Four at 9pm. The final episode of the drama The Walsh Sisters is on BBC One at 9:20pm. Just when everything is falling apart, can the sisters pull it back together? In Bill Bailey's Vietnam on Channel 4 at 9:20pm, the comedian visits the northern tip of the country. On to Sunday, the 29th of March. Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, featuring interviews with politicians and key public figures, is on BBC One at 9am. Over on Channel 4 at 9, there are two episodes of The Simpsons. Three chefs from North East England and Yorkshire serve their main courses and desserts in the Great British Menu at 11:30am on BBC Two. Four celebrities recreate their favourite childhood toys in biscuit form in the Great Celebrity Bake Off Stand Up to Cancer on Channel 4 at 7:40pm. Mary prepares for her official debut in London society in the first of two episodes of the drama The Other Bennett Sister, starting at 8pm on BBC One. A new four-part series of the crime drama Grace starts tonight on ITV One at 8pm. Detective Roy Grace is plunged into a dark and tangled investigation when the wife of a Brighton property developer goes missing. Pearson's colleagues face a crisis of confidence that take a dark turn in tonight's episode of the drama The Capture on BBC One at 9pm. The forensic team investigates when an 11-year-old girl is sexually assaulted. Forensics The Real CSI is on BBC Two at 9pm. Sandra Bullock and Ryan Reynolds star in the romantic comedy film The Proposal on BBC One at 10:30pm. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. On BBC One, Celebrity Homes Under the Hammer is at 11:15am and Bargain Hunt is at 12:15, both Monday to Friday. Just One Thing is at 2pm and The Repair Shop on the Road is at 3:45pm, both Monday to Thursday. Celebrity Catchphrase is on ITV One at 1pm Monday to Thursday. On Channel 4, there are four episodes of the sitcom Frasier starting at 9:10 Monday to Friday. Matt Baker, Our Farm in the Dales, is at 1:10 Monday to Thursday. On ITV 3, there are two episodes of Heartbeat starting at 5:50 and 6:55pm Monday to Thursday. Now for Monday, the 30th of March. It's Monday, so it must be quiz night on BBC Two, starting with Mastermind at 8, followed by University Challenge at 8:30pm. A family from Nottingham are shown how to streamline their culinary lifestyle to benefit their health and finances in Batch from Scratch, Cooking for Less, on Channel 4 at 8pm. Several choices at 9 tonight. A new drama series, Babies, starts on BBC One. 30-something couple Lisa and Stephen try for a baby, while a tense dinner with friends exposes hidden tensions. The battle for supremacy between China and the USA ramps up in the final episode of the documentary Clash of the Superpowers, America vs. China, on BBC Two at 9. The documentary Hunting the Silver Killer on ITV One at 9 investigates two disturbing murder-suicides still being examined some 30 years later. But could it have been a sadistic serial killer targeting the elderly? The Teacher on Channel 5 at 9 is a new four-part thriller showing nightly until Thursday. An experienced teacher at an elite private school becomes embroiled in an increasingly dangerous battle of wills with a popular student. The late-night film on BBC Two at 11 p.m. is the period mystery thriller The Prestige. Two Victorian magicians are rivals, but their bitter feud will only end when one of them is dead. Tuesday, 31st of March. We start the evening with football, with a friendly between England and Japan. Kick-off 7:45 p.m. on ITV1. Though not audio described, the commentary should give you an idea of the action. Stacey and team head to Milton Keynes to help a couple with five children under nine whose compact home is bursting at the seams. Sort Your Life Out with Stacey Solomon is on BBC One at 8 p.m. A family must choose between two adorable pets in tonight's episode of The Doghouse on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. Part 2 of the drama Babies is on BBC One at 9 p.m. The Hunt, Prey vs Predator continues on Channel 4 at 9, with seven players remaining, all vying to win up to £100,000. Wednesday, the 1st of April. Four contestants from Northern Ireland prepare dishes in an effort to earn a place at a banquet in Liverpool in tonight's episode of Great British Menu on BBC Two at 6:30 p.m. Continues Thursday and Friday at 7 p.m. Tonight's football shows live coverage of the quarter-final second leg match between Chelsea and Arsenal in the Women's Champions League. Kick-off 8 p.m. on BBC Two. More cherished heirlooms are brought into the barn for expert attention. The repair shop is on BBC One at 8 p.m. Kate Humble and JJ Chalmers are given unprecedented access to the Royal Navy, both at sea and at home, in this new six-part documentary, Warship, Life in the Royal Navy, on Channel 5 at 8 p.m. A farmer who crashed into a dry stone wall on his way to feed his animals and a woman who has fallen from her mobility scooter are just two of the patients needing help in ambulance on BBC One at 9 p.m. Britain is at war and Emma Hart searches for a way to keep her businesses afloat. A Woman of Substance is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. More than a decade after the Hatton Garden heist, this documentary asks what became of the gang and what happened to the missing millions. Hatton Garden, The Great Diamond Heist is on Channel 4 at 10 p.m. Thursday, the 2nd of April. Five duos embark on the ultimate adventure, travelling over 12,000 kilometres across Europe and Asia, in the battle to be the first over the line and win £20,000 in Race Across the World on BBC One at 8 p.m. A new series of the crime drama Queens of Mystery starts on the You and Drama channel at 8 p.m. Matty investigates a murder at Wild Marsh Wellness Retreat. The following two choices should appeal to Brenda Bledin fans. Another chance to see the penultimate episode of the crime drama Vera on ITV1 at 8:30 tonight, and the final episode at the same time tomorrow. Widowed and facing financial disaster, Emma takes it upon herself to find a solution. But can she really trust her sworn enemies? Find out in the final episode of A Woman of Substance on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. The Traitor stars embarks on a personal journey from Slough to Rome and Vatican City in search of answers about belief, identity, and what it means to be a good Catholic. Harry Clark Goes to Rome is on BBC One at 10:40 p.m. And so we come to Good Friday, the 3rd of April. The oldest British woman to complete an Ironman triathlon is the subject of tonight's Extraordinary Portraits with Bill Bailey on BBC One at 7:30pm. Humphrey and Esther arrive at a murder scene only to find it meticulously cleaned and restored. Beyond Paradise is on BBC One at 8pm. The final episode of Vera is on ITV One at 8:30pm. Connor and Jock are reunited after Jock makes an escape from a Colombian prison and stows away on a ship bound for Cork in the first episode of a new series of The Young Offenders on BBC One at 9:30pm. The late film on BBC One at 10pm is the Blackley comic drama based on a true story, The Wolf of Wall Street, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. With a mixture of documentaries, new dramas and football, I do hope that you find something in this week's selection that will appeal to you.
And now for a look at this week's radio recommendations, compiled by Angela Oram and read by Gilly Hamilton. Starting with Saturday the 28th of March, Alistair Cook's Letter from America was broadcast each week from 1908 to 2004. Alvin Hall revisits the programmes, looking at subjects as diverse as jazz, the Korean War, and George Bush to assess their relevance in the 21st century. That's in Alistair Cook's Footsteps at a choice of times, 7:40 a.m., 12:40 p.m., and 6:40 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Today's Radio 4 drama is 400 Strangers, about male asylum seekers in an East Midlands town and the reaction of the local community. As tensions rise in the town, an unexpected friendship offers a fragile thread of connection. 400 Strangers is at 3pm on Radio 4. Opera on 3 tonight presents a live New York Opera House performance of Verdi's La Traviata, the story of ill-fated courtesan Violetta and young bourgeois Alfredo, and their battle to realise true love before she succumbs to tuberculosis. La Traviata starts at 6pm on Radio 3. Archive on 4 tonight tells the story of the BBC and its Maida Vale studios, with reminiscences from the world of radio drama, wartime propaganda and classical music, featuring contributions and archive recordings from musicians and presenters past and present, including Jarvis Cocker, Annie Nightingale, John Peel and the Beatles. That's The Ghosts of Maida Vale at 8pm on Radio 4. On to Sunday, 29th of March. Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs this week is cook and presenter Cy King, the surviving half of TV's much-loved cookery team, the Hairy Bikers. Tune in to Radio 4 at 10am. It's repeated on Good Friday, the 3rd of April, at 9am. Over on Radio 2 is the Big Night of Musicals, where the casts of top West End and touring shows come together to perform stage hit favourites. Recorded on 26th of January at the AO Arena in Manchester, the two-hour show starts at 1pm on Radio 2. There's the second and final part of Flight, the musical adaptation of Walter White's 1926 novel. Mimi moves to Harlem, where she fully embraces life in the burgeoning city, but her past catches up with her at 3pm on Radio 4. Just before, at 2:45pm, in Opening Lines, John York explores why White's novel has largely been forgotten. And now a look at those programmes which are broadcast each day at the same time. Book of the Week is Radio Universe, a guide to how to explore space without leaving Earth, at 11:45am each day on Radio 4 and repeated each night at 12:30am. Polly Weston goes to a North Oxford housing estate where a blue plaque marks the removal of the Cuttislowe walls in 1959, brick barriers that stood more than 2 metres high, topped with revolving spikes that were erected in 1934 to separate new privately owned homes from council houses. Nearly 70 years later, Polly discovers the impact the walls have had. That's the shadow of the Cuttislow walls each day on Radio 4 at 1:45 p.m. Composer of the week, in fact there are two this week, are Hildegard of Bingen, 1098 to 1179, and Isabella Leonarda, 1620 to 1704. In the build-up to Easter, Donald MacLeod explores the life and music of two nuns who were also composers. Though born 5 centuries apart, their stories and music are connected by their shared faith and vocations. Composer of the Week is at 4 p.m. each day on Radio 3. Then in this week's The Essay, Juliet Stevenson stars as Hildegard of Bingen in a new fictionalised biographical work, The Lives of Hildegard of Bingen, by Anna Lindstrom, each night at 9:45 p.m. on Radio 3. Book at bedtime this week is Sea Scraper by Benjamin Wood. Thomas Flett, a young man struggling to earn a living in 1960s Lancashire, contemplates a different future when a Hollywood director arrives in the town at 10:45 p.m. each night on Radio 4. And here are some individual programmes to listen to throughout the week, starting with Monday the 30th of March. The Mystery of a Butcher's Shop, written in 1929, is the second of Gladys Mitchell's novels in the series about psychoanalyst-turned-amateur detective Mrs. Bradley. Broadcast over 2 days, today and Tuesday, you can hear this dramatisation at a choice of times on Radio 4 Extra, 6 a.m, 11 a.m, or 5 p.m. The drama Limelight, An Eye for a Killing, continues. In his prison cell, William Burke confesses to a journalist that he took part in 16 murders in the space of 10 months at 11 p.m. on Radio 4. Some suggestions for Tuesday, the 31st of March. Today's drama, based on a true story, is The Scrooge Identity, Hamburg, 1992, and a pipe bomb explodes in a department store. Shortly after, a ransom note signed Uncle Scrooge arrives, demanding a large sum of money at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Followed by History's Heroes, Alex von Tunzelmann looks into the story of Jessica Mitford, an aristocrat who rebelled against her family to become a civil rights activist. That's Jessica Mitford Finds Her Voice on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Actors, directors, producers and editors discuss what it was like to work with screenwriter Tom Stoppard, who died last year, sharing insights into how he navigated the process of bringing his work to audiences. With contributions from Bill Nighy and Toby Jones, Stoppard at Work is at 4 p.m. on Radio 4 and repeated on Saturday the 4th of April at 10:30 a.m. What's Up, Docs? This week has Chris and Sam Van Tulligum discussing the ways in which sunlight can help lift a person's mood and how it affects sleep and general well-being. What's Up, Docs? Is at 4:30 p.m. on Radio 4. Finally, for Tuesday the 31st of March, In Touch with Peter White is at 8:40 on Radio 4. Moving on to Wednesday the 1st of April. There's a new series of Life Changing, and this week Dr. Sian Williams talks to Emma Webber about her campaign for an inquiry into the death of her son Barnaby, who was killed in the Nottingham attacks of 2023, at 9 a.m. on Radio 4 and repeated on Good Friday, 3rd of April at 4:30 p.m. The dramatisation of A.J. Cronin's The Citadel is coming to a close. In the unsettling times of 1934, Denny and Mason are as busy as ever in their surgery, but both have decisions to make. At 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4, with the final part tomorrow, Thursday, at the same time. Radio 3 in concert tonight comes from the Royal Festival Hall, with the London Philharmonic Orchestra playing works by Mussorgsky, Pictures at an Exhibition, and Bartok, Violin Concerto No. 1. The live concert starts at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. Now, Thursday the 2nd of April, a new series of This Cultural Life opens with photographer Sir Don McCullin talking to John Wilson about his cultural influences and formative experiences. He started out in the 1950s, documenting the lives of the residents of the North London neighbourhood where he had grown up, before travelling to the front lines of conflict zones such as Cyprus, Beirut and Vietnam. This Cultural Life is at 11 a.m. on Radio 4 and repeated on Saturday the 4th of April at 7:15 p.m. Another new series, Scam Secrets, starts this week. Presenter Shari Val, criminal language expert Dr. Liz Carter and former fraudster Alex Wood hear about an emerging hybrid technique which combines investment and romance scams. Scam Secrets is at 12:04 on Radio 4. And don't forget the final part of The Citadel at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Finally, for Good Friday the 3rd of April, a new murder mystery starts today, Limelight Sabine. When Sabine's body is found beneath the cliffs at Beachy Head, her sister Ellie is convinced she was murdered. Ellie's hunt for the killer takes her deep into the secret life Sabine had kept hidden, at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. And we end this week's radio recommendations with Easter Reflections. The Reverend Kate Botley reflects on the themes of Good Friday and the hope and new beginnings to follow at Easter. She hears deeply personal stories from people who live with grief or difficulty and learns how their faith has enabled them to feel a sense of optimism about the future. There's a playlist of specially recorded gospel music, plus contributions from Taylor Swift and Dolly Parton. Easter Reflections is at 6 p.m. on Radio 2. Happy listening.
TNS Soundings.
News and information from Sandwell Council. New dog park and land train coming to Sandwell Valley this Easter weekend. Sandwell Council is continuing its transformation of Sandwell Valley into a more dog-friendly destination. Just in time for the Easter weekend, a brand new dog park will open alongside the return of popular land train rides, giving visitors and their four-legged companions even more reason to explore and enjoy the area. The dedicated space will provide a bookable, secure, fully fenced and enjoyable area where dogs can exercise, play and interact, while giving owners a comfortable place to spend quality time with their pets. Sessions cost £7.50 for 50 minutes and allow up to 3 dogs per booking. This new facility follows the recent installation of the first self-service dog wash at the Sandwell Valley Visitor Centre. Together, these new additions strengthen Sandwell Valley's appeal as an inclusive environment for people and their furry friends. The land train returns. As an Easter bonus, the Sandwell Valley land train returns from Friday the 3rd to Monday the 6th of April. The land train will offer return trips between Sandwell Valley Visitor Centre and Dartmouth Park, making it easier for visitors to explore both locations. Stops will be conveniently located outside the Visitor Centre reception and at the entrance to Dartmouth Park Pavilion. The service offers family-friendly fun for everyone, even well-behaved dogs, and is the perfect way to see more of the park without the long walk, making it easier for Easter days out. Train ride prices: an adult return is £3, a child return £2, a dog return, £2. A family, two adults, two children, return, £9. Adult one-way ticket, £2.50. Child one-way ticket, £1.50. Dog one-way ticket, £1.50. And a family, two adults, two children, one-way, £7. Further information will be posted on the Visit Sandwell website.
Welcome back to the Express and Star Pub Quiz. Entertainment news. Question one. Who is taking over from Richard Osmond as the host of BBC Two game show House of Games? Question two. A planned reboot of which beloved 90s series starring Sarah Michelle Gellar has been axed? Sport. Question three. Which Test cricket venue lies closest to the equator? Question four. Harriet Dart and Jodie Burridge play which sport? Remember when? Question five. Meryl Streep was born. Starlings on the minute hand made Big Ben lose 4.5 minutes and 7-inch records first became available in the USA. Question 6. Sweet rationing ended. John F. Kennedy married Jacqueline Bouvier. Ian Fleming published his first James Bond novel, Casino Royale, and Joseph Starling died. But what was the year? Who am I? Question 7. A children's author, I was born in Nottinghamshire in 1934. I worked as a teacher before becoming a full-time writer and was first published in 1960. My acclaimed novels for children often combined fantasy with reality and included Lizzie Dripping and Moondial, which was adapted into a successful children's BBC series. I passed away in September 2005. Question 8. A rapper and garage singer, I was born in London in 1981. My real name is Naomi McLean Daly, and I was the eldest of 11 siblings. I was awarded the Mercury Prize in 2002 for my debut album, A Little Deeper, making me the second female solo artist to be awarded the prize in the history of the award. Local knowledge. Question 9. Which comedian from Acox Green is widely credited with introducing the American word zit into the British vocabulary? And question 10. Which West Midlands Speciality Museum was crowned the best large visitor attraction of the year at the English Tourism Awards 2025, pipping the National Space Centre and Liverpool Football Club tours to gold? How's your quiz knowledge? Click to the answers to find out. Here are the answers to this week's quiz. Entertainment news. Question 1. Who is taking over from Richard Osmond as the host of BBC Two game show House of Games? Michael Sheen. Question 2. A planned reboot of which beloved 90s series starring Sarah Michelle Gellar has been axed? Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Sport. Question 3. Which Test cricket venue lies closest to the equator? The Gaul International Stadium in Sri Lanka. Question 4. Harriet Dart and Jodie Burridge play which sport? Tennis. Remember when? Question 5. Meryl Streep was born. Starlings on the minute hand made Big Ben lose 4.5 minutes, and 7-inch records first became available in the USA. But what was the year? 1949. Question 6. Sweet rationing ended. John F. Kennedy married Jacqueline Bouvier. Ian Fleming published his first James Bond novel, Casino Royale, and Joseph Starling died. But what was the year? 1953. Who am I? Question 7. A children's author, I was born in Nottinghamshire in 1934. I worked as a teacher before becoming a full-time writer and was first published in 1960. My acclaimed novels for children often combined fantasy with reality and included Lizzie Dripping and Moondial, which was adapted into a successful children's BBC series. I passed away in September 2005. Helen Cresswell. Question 8. A rapper and garage singer, I was born in London in 1981. My real name is Naomi McLean Daly, and I was the eldest of 11 siblings. I was awarded the Mercury Prize in 2002 for my debut album, A Little Deeper, making me the second female solo artist to be awarded the prize in the history of the award. Ms. Dynamite. Local knowledge. Question 9. Which comedian from Acox Green is widely credited with introducing the American word zit into the British vocabulary? Jasper Carrot. And question 10. Which West Midlands Speciality Museum was crowned the best large visitor attraction of the year at the English Tourism Awards 2025, pipping the National Space Centre and Liverpool Football Club tours to gold? The Black Country Living Museum. Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back next time. Bye!
We're going to hear from Sophia again, who's working on a history project with the Beacon Centre, interviewing blind vision impaired people about their experiences in life.
The Beacon Centre in Wolverhampton are running a oral history project recording the history of people with sight loss. It's in partnership with the National Heritage Lottery Fund, so that's kind of where we have got the funding for the project. Working on a social history project to capture the experience of people with sight loss for future generations and to record their stories in the local archives. So we're basically interviewing people who have lived experience of sight loss and talking to them, learning a bit more about their experiences. All the interviewers have their own experiences with sight loss, so we are kind of guided by our own experiences. And really, the project is to try and make a difference in the local area, and through lived experience. We want to be able to share people's experiences at the archive, so people can learn from people with sight loss, and hopefully we can change the archives themselves. And we have people working on trying to make the archive more accessible so people with sight loss can access it.
So this archive, who is that being administered or run by?
At the moment, I think the archives are run by the local council. So it is the archive and Wolverhampton Archive, off the top of my head.
The age range of people you're interviewing, is it a wide range, or does it tend to be older people? Because when you say history, oral history, you tend to think of the past, but is it really that?
It can be anyone, young adult to older. I think we are kind of interviewing people who are 18 and up. I'm not sure if we're allowed to interview like younger teenagers, I think.
So would it be right to say it's their experience now and then?
Yeah, so it's basically people's life journey with their sight impairment. We start the interview talking a little bit about maybe like childhood experiences and going on to kind of how you live your life, like daily difficulties as a result of sight impairment and any kind of things that you'd like to see change in the local area.
So, to home in on particular areas, have you had people talking, for example, about school integration or specialist education, that sort of thing, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. So the project's kind of aim is to capture those experiences, capture people's thoughts and try and to extend people's empathy towards people with sight loss and what people with sight loss want sighted people to know. So definitely to do with the people's school experiences and work experiences and how we can use these experiences to shape the systems that are in place today.
And work experiences, you often get the impression these days that so many people with sight loss or blind people or vision impaired aren't working these days. I wonder if you've touched much on working life and what people have done, various careers and jobs they've had.
With kind of the, like you say, there is that difficulty that people with sight impairments have getting into work. In terms of specifics, like I say, I can't share anything due to confidentiality, but generally I think it's good to listen to people's experiences and also their challenges in getting work. I think from my own personal experience, getting support to get into work with a sight impairment is challenging, and kind of using that sort of feedback that we get from people, I think going forward will be great, because I think having that database of kind of people's stories and experiences, it's a way of informing people of people with sight loss's journey in life, how we go through day to day and our struggles, and that will help people hopefully understand them better, how they work with people, and hopefully people will be more willing to kind of employ people with sight loss if they listen to these kind of stories.
You're based around Dudley and Wolverhampton, but how about people from outside those areas? Do you want to hear from them, or are you more restricted to Dudley and Wolverhampton?
As far as I'm aware, it's within the Staffordshire and Dudley area, so kind of Dudley, Wolverhampton and the kind of edge of Birmingham. I think we are touching on some of the people's stories from Birmingham as well.
So I think, you know, for any of our listeners, particularly those who live on the border of Samwell and Dudley, Tipton going into Dudley, that sort of area, Sophia might like to hear from you.
If you contact the Beacon Centre, I can pass on the information of who to contact there, because it will be through them.
All this is being recorded, I presume, so is there access yet to some of the work you've done, or is that yet to come?
That is yet to come. The work should be available, I believe, from September. The interviews finish in September this year, and the plan is to have everything in the archives, I believe, by then. But it's a work in progress, and the project itself is still ongoing, so I can't really give a concrete date to when everything will be ready.
If you'd like to get in touch with the Beacon Centre, then you can call them on 01902 880 111. Their website is at https://beaconvision, which is all one word, .org.
Dear SVI members and friends, at last, spring is in the air. The birds are singing, the buds are starting to burst, and we are looking forward to some nice dry and sunny days to move into April and May. We do hope you can join us for one or more of the activities below. Tea and toast the first Wednesday of the month from 10:30 a.m. till 12 noon. Come along for tea, toast and a chat with SVI friends. On Wednesday the 1st of April, we have Lydia Turton from The Beacon to tell us about their new oral history programme and how you can get involved. As well as toast, we will have hot cross buns on offer. Yummy. Our May tea and toast is on Wednesday the 6th of May and a speaker is still to be confirmed. Park Ride Accessible Cycling is back in Sandwell Valley starting on Monday the 13th of April from 10:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. SVI and Mencat Park Ride have partnered up again to bring a series of 4 free accessible cycling sessions to Sandwell Valley. In the past, these sessions have been very popular and we're keen to welcome back familiar faces as well as anyone new who's curious to give cycling a go. The park ride team believe that there's an accessible bike or trike for everyone's needs. Contact us to book your place. Let's talk about IT. Monday the 13th of April, 12:30pm to 2:30pm at the SVI office. Come along to join us for an informal session where we'll chat about all things IT. Whether you're a tech whiz or just getting started, everyone's welcome. Contact the SVI office to book your place. Men's group, Wednesday the 15th of April from 10:30am, trip to the Ozzy Osbourne exhibition at the Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery. Travelling together on the metro from West Bromwich, our men will spend an hour or two around the exhibition and finish the day with lunch in Birmingham. Contact the office for more details and to be added to the register. On Wednesday the 20th of May, join the men at the SVI office for relaxed chat, informative guest speakers and tabletop accessible games like dominoes. We want more men to join our men's group and welcome ideas of what we could do in the future. Unlocking potential, getting more involved. Thursday the 16th of April, West Bromwich Town Hall from 11am to 2:30pm. We want to work with you, our members and volunteers, to see how we can keep SVI activities and services going in the face of forthcoming council funding cuts. Our Unlocking Potential Day will be a great opportunity for us to work together to look at how you might get more involved or what might stop you from doing more. Even the smallest bit of help can make a difference. The day will be lively and informative, with speakers from a range of services, small focus groups and lunch will be provided. Please join us to share your ideas. This day is funded through the Esme Fairburn EPIC programme. Social Eyes Fundraising Meal, Akash Balti, Carter Green, West Bromwich, Monday the 20th of April, 6:30pm onwards. After a long gap following COVID, we're making a welcome return to see our friends at the Akash restaurant, who have very kindly agreed to hold a fundraising evening for the SVI Social Eyes group. We will meet at the Akash at 6:30pm onwards, and at £20 each, the meal will include poppadoms, a starter, a main, a side dish from the menu. Half of the takings from this evening's meal will be donated to the Socialise group, and this will help us to run more activities and trips at subsidised costs. There will also be a raffle. There is a licensed bar at the restaurant, and you can either purchase drinks on the night or take your own. As we have to block book the restaurant, payment to SVI needs to be made in advance. Please contact the office to book your place. SVI Rocks is back. First session on Wednesday the 22nd of April from 10am to 12 noon. Join Rodrigo and Sarah Ann for our popular SVI Rocks session in the SVI Common Room. Sing or bring along an instrument and make some noise with us. Boost your musical skills and confidence. The second session will be on Wednesday the 13th of May with more sessions to follow, leading up to a performance at SVI's open meeting on Monday the 13th of July. Contact us to book your place. Nature Connection activities, starting Thursday the 23rd of April from 1:30pm. From April until October, you can join a series of Nature Connection guided walks at Oak House, West Bromwich and in West Smethwick Park. Sophie from Wonder in Nature will guide you in gentle, mindful walks. These sessions will offer a chance to slow down, connect more deeply with nature and each other. Each session will include a nature-based creative activity and time for refreshments. Over the course of the project, we also plan to capture an audio story of the Nature Connection experiences and create a nature-inspired art piece as a group. The first session will be on Thursday the 23rd of April at Oak House, 1:30pm to 4pm, leaving from the SVI offices. More details will be provided nearer the time. Other sessions will be on the first Monday of each month between June and October from 1:30pm to 4pm. Please contact SVI to sign up for the walks. Sandwell Talking News AGM, Monday the 27th of April, 1pm to 3:30pm, SVI Common Room. If you're interested in hearing more about Sandwell Talking News or getting involved, you're welcome to come along to the annual general meeting. There will be a guest speaker too, details to be confirmed. Aquafit is back, Wednesday the 29th of April, 1 till 2pm at Portway Lifestyle Centre. Get summer body ready. Aquafit restarts on Wednesday the 29th of April for 12 weeks. Gentle toning activity in the water is suitable for everyone with expert instructor Alison. Contact SVI if you're interested. SVI's women's group invites you to a taste of something different on Thursday the 30th of April at 12:30pm at Oak Cafe, 614 Bearwood Road, B66 4BW. Dig into Vietnamese comfort food and more at Oak Cafe. Whether you fancy the classic pho beef or the lighter pho chicken, the bowls are packed with authentic flavours. There are plenty of other options too, including cake for those with a sweet tooth. Made with care and top-notch ingredients, you will leave the nice full tummies and a smile on your face. Let us know if you're coming so we can reserve the tables. You will order and pay on the day. Chance Heritage Trust Guided Walk, Thursday the 7th of May from 10:30 a.m. The Chance Heritage Trust will be holding an Access to Heritage Open Day on the 7th of May in West Smethwick Park. The day will include guided heritage walks around the park and interactive chance glass history displays in the pavilion. Sophie from Wonder in Nature will lead the walks. Sandwell visually impaired members are invited to join a walk at 10:30 a.m. on the 7th of May, followed by an interactive history talk which will include exploring chance glass heritage items. Please contact SVI to sign up to the event. The Chance Brothers were pioneers in glassmaking, known for their innovative design. They supplied the glass to over 2,500 lighthouses around the world. The Chance Glass Factory was established in Smethwick in 1822. West Smethwick Park was opened in 1895 on land donated by James Timmins Chance. The Chance Heritage Trust is working to bring back to life the legacy of heritage assets, and we are delighted to give you the opportunity to find out more about this important part of Sandwell's history. Socialise visit to the Fixed Wheel Brewery, Saturday the 9th of May at 1 p.m. Come and have a look round this Blackheath-based microbrewer. Meet Scott Povey, who will give us a guided talk, with two pints or four halves and a tasty carb included in the price. He will talk us through the brewing process, and where possible, we will taste, feel and smell the main ingredients used. The cost of the tour, including tastings and the carb, is £15. Contact us to book your place. Socialise trip to the Lockup, West Midlands Police Museum, Thursday the 21st of May. Step inside Birmingham's historic Victorian Lockup and experience life on both sides of the bars. Join us for a guided tour followed by tea and biscuits. Built in 1891 and used as a working police cell block until 2016, this unique museum brings two centuries of policing to life. Learn about notorious local criminals like the real Peaky Blinders and about the officers who worked at the Lockup. It's a fascinating and fun trip out. We will travel on the Metro, meeting at West Bromwich bus station at 9:45 a.m. Cost, including travel, is £10 per person. Don't forget your travel pass. Contact us to book your place. Active 60 trip to the Valley, Evesham, Thursday, May the 28th. Join us for some fresh country air and a day out at the Valley, Evesham, with cafes, outdoor activities, a garden centre and shops. There's something for everyone. There's even a little train that will take you around the country park if you don't fancy the walk. We will meet at West Bromwich bus station at 9:45 a.m. for a 10 a.m. prompt departure. Cost of travel per person is £15. There's no entrance fee for the Valley. However, there is a charge for the train and some other activities. Contact SVI to book and pay in advance. Supported gym sessions every Tuesday, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Portway Lifestyle Centre. Break a sweat and boost your energy with fellow SVI members. From treadmills and bikes to weights, there's something for everyone and plenty of support to help you along the way. It's a fun social way to stay fit and active all year round, rain or shine. Every Tuesday, 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m, line dancing at Dartmouth Central Club. Put on your dancing shoes and join Ray and Jean for a lively dancing session full of fun and feel-good moves. Whether you're looking to stay active, improve your balance or simply meet new people, it's a perfect chance. Absolute beginners are welcome. Just come along and enjoy. We'd love to see you on the dance floor. Showdown every Wednesday afternoon from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at Portway Lifestyle Centre. Showdown will be every Wednesday from 1 p.m. until the 22nd of April. It moves to Thursday mornings from the 30th of April. Come and join us for this fast-moving, interactive sport, similar to table tennis and air hockey. Designed for blind and visually impaired people, but anyone can play. Contact the SVI office for more information. Booking and payments. All activities must be booked in advance. Spaces fill up fast. Call 0121 525 4810 or email info@sandwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk to reserve your spot. We can now take card payments in person or over the phone. You can also pay by bank transfer or cash. Just get in touch and we'll help you with the details. We look forward to seeing you at one or more of our upcoming events. Warm wishes from the SVI team.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, my name is Lindsay. I started producing topical items during lockdown to keep my neighbours entertained. All the recordings are made inside my cosy cabin, for that extra sense of calm. And naturally enough, I call them cabin conversations. I hope you enjoy them. Cabin conversations about Easter Monday traditions. Easter Sunday, the main event, will fall on the 5th of April this year, with the Easter Monday public holiday on the 6th of April for England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Scotland now has several local authorities acknowledging the Easter Monday holiday, and while the rest of Britain officially declared it under the Bank Holidays Act of 1871, Scottish banks only changed their opening days from 1996. As for the actual calendar date, the earliest possible Mondays are the 23rd of March and the latest the 26th of April. So why do these celebration dates vary each year? Well, it all relates to different faith calendars deciding the set beginning of the spring equinox in March, combined with the new full moon in the same period. Whereas in reality, the seasons actually shift according to astronomy calculations. Emperor Constantine, the first Christian Roman leader, in 325 AD, had the first council of Christian bishops stipulate when Easter should occur. They chose the first Sunday after the full moon, on or after the spring equinox, on the 21st of March, the same as today's observance. But it did not close the matter for many more centuries. Celtic Britain even wanted their own way, commemorating Good Friday on a Thursday. In England, a case of providence was argued between Celtic monks and Roman monks, which was settled by the Northumbrian King Oswy, who, despite having been raised in a Celtic kingdom and following their customs, his native Kent wife practised Roman. Oswy requested the Synod of Whitby Abbey in 664 to formally agree on Easter. They chose in favour of the Roman calendar and traditions, thus creating harmony in the royal court and structure for the country. Naturally, this upset the Celtic monks' leader, Bishop Colman of Lindisfarne, who promptly resigned and took his fellow devout monks with him to Scotland, never to return. Therefore, faith days have remained quite strict, though the Easter Monday public holiday less so, with mainly pagan-influenced activities across the UK. The Hocktide festival holiday, spanning both Monday and Tuesday after Easter, originated from medieval times, around the 11th century, and marks the end of winter on the land. Celebrated for 2 weeks in Hungerford, Berkshire today, it is an opportunity for the parish to raise funds. A town crier calls Hocktide Court in the privately owned town hall, while the tutti men, or tutti women these days, walk door to door carrying their tutti wooden poles, are topped with flower posies and ribbons. Their job, to collect small tithe fees. They are accompanied by tutti girls with wicker baskets of sweets and someone with a sack of oranges, so that residents who pay can receive an orange in exchange. These tithes, or rents, are for fishing the local rivers and cattle grazing on the common, along with rites to pick watercress. Afterwards, a grand feast using local fish, beef and watercress to symbolise further the event. Many ancient and old customs are involved during the festival, ale tasting and a blacksmith simulating horseshoeing a newcomer to the feast. In Leicestershire, a bottle-kicking match takes place, a custom thought to go back 2,000 years. The two villages of Hallerton and Medbourne first parade a hare rabbit pie through the streets and behind three small wooden barrels described originally as bottles, one solid wood and the other two filled with beer. The object of the game is to move the best of three barrels to the other side of one of the village streams, by whatever means possible, as having no official rules. In fact, it has been likened to an early form of rugby. The winning team who gets any barrel onto the village green takes the spoils. Another Herculean race is held in Gawthorpe, Wakefield, Yorkshire, for the World Coal Carrying Championships, split into several categories. The Children's Fun Run, for a distance of 100 yards or 91 metres to the village green. All the adults, men, women and veterans 40 years and over, start their races from the public house in Ossett, covering 0.6 of a mile or 1,012 metres to finish at the Maypole Green in Gawthorpe. The only variation between them being the weight carried. The women each take 44 pounds, that's 20 kilos of coal, and the men 110 pounds, or 50 kilos of coal. Despite the hindrance of carrying such weights, the men's record set in 1995 was 4 minutes, 6 seconds. Although for many, Easter Monday means reflecting on the value of faith and leisure time spent with family and friends. May you mark the end of winter and the beginning of spring in your own distinct way.
TNF Soundings.
Thank you to all our Sandwell volunteers who've read the Express and Star articles for us. Debbie, Lauren, Sarbjit, Jenny and Kate, along with Sarah Ann for doing the quiz. And a big thank you to Jan for doing the Sandwell Visually Impaired Activities letter. Have a wonderful Easter, everybody. I hope you enjoy yourselves and have plenty of eggs, but not too many.
I'll try not to have too many Easter eggs. And thanks, Pam, for stepping in to read Wednesday's news. I don't know what's happened to James, but I hope he's okay. Just left to me to wish you a happy Easter, and don't forget the Talking News AGM towards the end of April, which was in the newsletter. And do get the pen drives back to us ASAP. Bye-bye from me, Ray. And look forward to being back with you after Easter.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.